This is the Quality News Network. The Pentagon will alert 8 National Guard units to be ready to go either to Iraq or Afghanistan by late summer of 2008. 7 units will deploy to Iraq and 1 to Afghanistan to help bolster security levels. Meantime, a Texas Army brigade due to return from the Diyala province will not be replaced. That will begin downsizing of the U.S. military in Iraq by Christmas. The Iraqi government is urging Turkey not to cross its northern border to combat Kurdish separatists. Parliament okayed that today. Despite stinging criticism from China, President Bush appeared with the Dalai Lama today to award him the Congressional Gold Medal. The House Foreign Affairs Committee says it wants Yahoo's chief executives to testify about allegedly providing sensitive information to Beijing, which resulted in the jailing of a prominent Chinese dissident journalist. Several of the largest food companies in the United States are under a federal investigation suspected of overcharging for supplies furnished to U.S. troops in Iraq. Corporations being probed include ConAgra, Sara Lee, and Purdue Farms. After 8 years of self-imposed exile, former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto will return home to Karachi. She could face arrest and trial on corruption charges dating back for several years. In Tehran, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared his country would never accept U.S. military action against Iran. It's the first time in 50 years a Russian leader has visited that country. Myanmar state media today said the country's dictatorship arrested nearly 3,000 pro-democracy advocates. 500 are being held so far. The military junta said arrests are ongoing. Yesterday, Myanmar's largest donor, Japan, cut off all aid. In New York, 2 men extradited from Romania faced a federal judge on U.S. terrorism charges. The 2 are suspected of passing millions of dollars in weaponry to Colombian rebels. In his first major press conference since being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, former Vice President Al Gore reconfirmed today he will not enter the 2008 presidential race. Indonesian authorities today ordered 100,000 residents to evacuate an area near the Javanese volcano Mount Kelud. Scientists predict the volcano could erupt soon. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Did you know 1 billion adults around the world cannot read? 2/3 are women, many prohibited from learning. The rate of illiteracy is declining, but the number who can't read has been increasing. These are more than just numbers, they're people. They're your friends, neighbors, and even your family. Consider these numbers. In America, if you didn't speak English in your home, you're 44% more likely to be reading below the most basic level. If you didn't complete high school, the chances are good that you can't read. 85% of prisoners are illiterate, as are the kids who wind up in juvenile court. Here are the facts. If you can read, you can learn, get a better job, and make more money. If you can't read, you can't learn, you can't find a good job, you can't make a decent living. Choose smart. Learn to read. If you're out of school, find a literacy program through your local library.
This message on literacy has been brought to you as a public service by the Quality News Network. For more information, please contact your local library.
A Shanghai newspaper said today China's trade surplus this year is expected to top $250 billion and its inflation rate at 4%. The U.S. has long contended China's yuan is undervalued. Seagate Technology says strong sales translated into an 18% spike in quarterly profit. The company exceeded analyst projections with revenues of nearly $3.3 billion. Intel announced a 43% increase in quarterly profit on revenues of $1.86 billion. Silicon Valley-based company credited strong sales of microprocessors. Shares of Yahoo surged 9% after the company posted a smaller-than-expected dip in quarterly profit. IBM beat Wall Street expectations by announcing a 6% surge in quarterly earnings and a profit of $2.36 billion. Light sweet crude trading at $87.40 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. That's down 21 cents. Gold at $762.50 an ounce, up 50 cents. And at today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 20 points at 13,892. NASDAQ up 28 points at 2792. The S&P 500 up 3 points at 1541. And there's always more on our website at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 57 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day, and today is, in fact, Wednesday, October the 17th. So if you are listening on a Wednesday evening at about 9 p.m. Eastern Time on October the 17th, you are indeed listening to a live program, and you are welcome to phone in and talk to myself and to the guest who will be joining us shortly, and I will be introducing her shortly. The call-in number is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877, the number 4, head-on. Translates to being 877-443-2366. Or if you have an unlimited long-distance plan, please use 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. That rings in West Virginia, and it will save the studio a nickel or a buck. Mail arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I normally try to check the mail during the breaks. The show site, I should point out, is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. There you're going to find links to all of the guests, to the guest site. It's organized by calendar date. You'll find links to the audio archives from the past shows, as well as to our chat room, which is active as I speak, and I am there, and I'm monitoring it to take questions from the chatters or from the emailers or from the callers, and you can speak with our guests if you just dial in. There are links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, also to the Head On Radio Network main site, and there you can find out about all of the progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are links there also for the Strictly Confidential MySpace page, and you'll find links to locate the music that you hear on the show. There are a number of fine music links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. The site is easy to use and is pretty much a one-page design, so it's not difficult to find archives, previous shows, or guest links. Our guest this evening is Lisa Krensky. She is the director of the LGBT Aging Project in Boston, Massachusetts. This organization works to ensure that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender elders have equal access to life-prolonging benefits, protections, services, and institutions that their heterosexual neighbors take for granted. Ms. Krensky has worked in both client services and management of mainstream community-based elder care agencies for about 17 years. She is gracious to join us this evening, and I'm so pleased to have you on the show. Welcome to Strictly Confidential, Ms. Krensky.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have you on. As I explained to you, I believe in one of our previous conversations when we were setting up a show date, our audience is varied. We have a large number of straight listeners. We inherit from the Bob Kincaid Show, which is previous to this. They are progressive straight folks who are sympathetic to us, but don't necessarily understand us, but we are making inroads to that every day. One of the things we do on this show is to bust stereotypes. We also, of course, have a large number of LGBT folks that join us at 9 p.m. So it's a varied audience, and I'm very pleased to have you on talking about this because it's very much a hidden issue. Before we get into that, maybe you could tell us your background and about the LGBT Project and how you came to join the project.
Sure, it'd be my pleasure. The LGBT Aging Project was founded in 2001, and the way that we were created really was that there were many of us who worked in the mainstream elder care network in Massachusetts and know that we have a terrific infrastructure for providing services to elders, but despite how good our system is, we really didn't have LGBT elders on the radar screen at all. And we also knew that the LGBT community which had terrific strengths and resources, really didn't have their own elders on the radar screen. And so older LGBT folks were basically falling through the cracks, and we were concerned about that. And so we held a summit. We brought about 150 providers together, both LGBT activists and elder care providers and a variety of folks. And from that, we put together a 10-point action plan with a 3-year projected time frame for accomplishing our goals, things like bringing trainings to mainstream elder care, looking at housing opportunities for LGBT seniors, getting the equivalent of civil marriage rights to LGBT seniors. And we are now, I believe, in the 7th or 8th year of our 3-year action plan.
Well, that's great progress. Can you tell us more about your clients and what services that you provide?
Sure. We really see ourselves as having a dual constituency, and one of our first constituencies is the network of elder care providers that is out there. I had, prior to my joining the Aging Project, I had worked for many years in a number of the community-based elder service agencies in the Boston area, and so we really are working with many folks who have good intention and want to be providing good care to the elders that they are working with, and simply sort of aren't attuned to the issues that are unique for LGBT seniors. So that's one constituency group that we work with. And then the second one that we work with obviously is trying to make connections with LGBT seniors and their caregivers, and really connecting to those folks who may be unfamiliar with the community-based resources that are available to them.
Well, Lisa, I understand that your group was a founder or one of the founders of a national group of LGBT aging projects. Is that true? And can you tell us how you're approaching this nationally from Massachusetts?
Absolutely. We have been and remain a relatively small organization, mostly volunteer involved. Myself as a full-time staff person, and then just within the last year, we've brought on an outreach and education coordinator. But we are the only folks in New England who are doing this work, and we have been able to connect with other people across the country who are doing similar work, but we're all fairly, you know, geographically isolated. And so through the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, we have been able to come together for the roundtable through the task force, the roundtable on LGBT aging. And that's been a terrific opportunity for about 30 of us nationwide to gather together and to talk about not only what are we each individually doing across the country, but then also to sort of say, how do we build a nationwide agenda for LGBT aging?
So the national what is the name again, please, of the hub, the parent organization?
Well,
the
it's national Gay Task Force. Task Force, otherwise known as the Task Force.
I see, and they
and they have been the host organization for the meetings of the LGBT aging roundtable.
Now, do they provide management, or are they more a communication facility to facilitate communication?
They are, they really, in this case, have been convening these meetings and bringing folks from Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C., I'm forgetting communities, and I apologize, but folks really all over the country to come together and to talk about these issues and to talk about, you know, the variety of issues that we're all dealing with around LGBT aging, be it housing, health care, socialization, community-based issues, that kind of thing. So they're really facilitating a broader conversation.
Well, are all of the state organizations calling themselves the LGBT Aging Project? Is there some standard for people to contact statewide?
Nope. We are, the LGBT Aging Project is the name of our organization, and just represents the group of us who are working in Massachusetts. And then there are varieties of other organizations nationwide that are up and running, and but those vary from state to state.
So the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force then would have a website space devoted to locating the various organizations.
I believe that they do, and if not, and there were folks who were interested in wanting to know if there's something particular in their area, they could certainly contact the task force for that information, and if not, they could always contact me through our website, the LGBTAgingProject.org, and I would try and connect them to the information. It's not as if there's sort of one organization that's listed in every community. It really is about sort of where individual organizations have begun to develop a grassroots effort.
Well, Ms. Krinsky, as we've discussed, the New York Times has really taken the lid off of this, being the gray lady herself, and I say kudos to them for doing that. You are, of course, mentioned in the article, and that you are working to create cultural competency training sessions. Can you tell us what that means, a cultural competency
session? Absolutely. We were thrilled to be contacted by a reporter from the New York Times and to participate in the story that she presented to folks. And basically the model that we're using right now that I use when I'm training mainstream providers is sort of what's most commonly understood to people, sort of cultural competency training, and that means that lots of organizations understand that they have a broad and diverse group of clients that they serve, and so we've been paying attention as people are attuned to thinking about, you know, cultural competency along racial lines, around linguistic lines, that lots of places know that with the change in demographics, it's really important to have a Spanish-speaking person on staff. It's really important to have somebody who, you know, to have your materials translated. That's an element of cultural competency. And so what I've come forth to bring to organizations is an idea that it's important to have cultural competency when dealing with LGBT seniors, that there's an LGBT culture, and that knowledge of that culture is important for folks to be as effective as possible.
Are you finding that the people who are contacting you are more from profit care facilities or nonprofit care facilities?
That's a great question. I have primarily been working with nonprofit organizations. My work history is that I've worked in the state network of elder care providers. And so that's been the place where initially I've gone back to do this education and training. So these are folks who are receiving, you know, state or federal funded dollars to provide services for elders in their community. But I've also begun to do some other work with, you know, for-profit entities that are also committed to providing the best services possible for the elders that they work with.
I see. So the nonprofits tend to not be chain-oriented, so this is an individual, they're contacting you individually then, as opposed to some head organization. Am I understanding that correctly?
I've had some contact with some larger organizations that are part of a broader national network of care providers. And I've also done quite a bit through the state network of care providers. So a mixture of both.
Well, how does it break down regionally? Example, the South has a reputation for having some pretty bad attitudes about the LGBT community. Of course, that's not universally true, but generally you can make that statement. How is the input from the South and other areas of the country, particularly the rural areas?
You know what? The majority of my work is within Massachusetts. And what I have seen is, in terms of this one state, I've done a broad range of work across the state. So I've had the opportunity to work in urban areas and suburban and rural, you know, more rural areas in Massachusetts. But I haven't yet, as a very small organization with just two staff people, haven't branched out throughout the country yet.
In talking about aging issues in general, generally speaking, I think young Americans are purported to basically have no contact with the elderly in general. Young people basically have no interest in the history or the wealth of experience that elderly Americans have to offer. There seems to be a great disparity in communication, with the exception of direct family members, grandfathers, the grandmothers, etc.
Right.
There is a thought that, in fact, there are people who are saying that the gay community or the LGBT community is especially vicious about this separation. There's an example given. You may have read this. It's from an article called Elephant Graveyards, Gay and Aging Ageism by Patricia Warren. She wrote it in 2000. Her example is that at a recent awards ceremony, there was a pioneering, an aging activist, an LGBT activist, who was having trouble getting up to the podium to accept an award with a walker. And, you know, there was this long, awkward silence, and some of the people, you know, snickered in the audience, and nobody got up to help this person as they tried to make it with their walker up the steps to get to the stage. And one of the people commented, it was one of those moments that made me ashamed to be gay. Do you think this is just heaping on punishment to the gay community or criticism to the gay community, or do you in general feel that the ageism and sexism is more severe in the gay community, the LGBT community?
You know, it's a really difficult question. I mean, I think it speaks in some ways to a lot of the work that I do, where I will say that, you know, LGBT seniors are exposed to all of the struggles and difficulties and benefits and pleasures that all seniors are exposed to. So our broader culture is, you know, just filled with ageism, and we see that in you know, our media and in lots of other places. And so to say that it is more severe in the LGBT community, I think is a far stretch. I think that you know, some people have certainly said, particularly for gay men, that it's a significant factor. You know, I think that there certainly is ageism in the LGBT community. And as you sort of described that very poignant image of somebody who is older and really, you know, trying to make their way forward to accept an award, what strikes me about that is one of the things that I think is unique to the LGBT community, and as we relate to older folks in our own community, is that for, you know, 98, that is, this is not a real statistic, I'm making it up, 98% of us are born into heterosexual families, which means that we do not grow up with the type of LGBT history being passed down from generation to generation. If you're born into a family of a particular culture or a particular, you know, geographic area, your family, as you're growing up, tells you those stories. You know, this is what it means, like, this is what it means to be, you know, from an Italian family, and this is the food we eat, and this is what we celebrate, and here's the story of our coming to this country. For LGBT folks, we have no foremothers and forefathers to tell us those stories. And so it really is an additional value to hear the stories that those people have to tell, because we don't get that in any other place in our LGBT lives. And so I consider sort of LGBT seniors to be that much more of a valuable resource for younger folks, because if you don't turn to these people to tell you their life stories, where or how are you going to learn these things?
Well, that's well said, and in fact, I believe your understanding of it is very similar to mine. As I read through the anecdotes that this person tells in the article, in each case, now you could certainly extrapolate that to apply to the straight community too, in terms of, you know, hanging with people your own age, and young people don't talk to older guys in public or hang out with them. All of these things, you know. The sugar daddy complex, and you know, not wanting to appear. Right? There's so many of these things, these anecdotes that could apply across the board. And you make a very good point of the lack of connection that we have from generation to generation. In fact, that connection has been non-existent. We have had to start over again and again and again and invent ourselves. And I think it creates a huge vacuum in our lives. And it's, you know, as people age and begin to understand these things, it must be awfully hard to go back in the closet. And I understand that's what's required to exist in some care facilities.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I had some trouble hearing.
I'm saying that as people age and they begin to appreciate the lack of passed on history between the young and the old. As they age and end up in care facilities, it must be very difficult for them, knowing these things, to go back into the closet.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, for folks who have sort of lived through their lives and found, you know, I think for folks who have found sort of a comfortable place to be in their lives with their identity, that the process, of having to relinquish that identity and go back into the closet is something that is either a very painful process to experience or is something that inspires them to resist any kind of intervention that might lead them to that point. You know, there are then stories of people who say, you know, I would rather kill myself than end up in a nursing home with, you know, a homophobic roommate and or staff and feel like I have to go back in the closet. I mean, that's the most dramatic example of what people might fear. I won't call, I won't see my doctor, I won't tell anybody that I'm having difficulty, moving around my apartment because they'll send somebody in and, you know, something drastic will happen. But I will lose the quality of life that I have and my own sense of identity if I have to engage with a system that I perceive to be hostile and unwelcoming, regardless of whether those folks are going to be hostile and unwelcoming or not.
Well said. Can you tell us more about some of the things that many of our listeners... I think we all understand that aging is not always an easy thing. We have, our expectations, our body images. Aging is not a picnic. In other words, aging is not for sissies, I've heard it said. But
right.
What are the, can you tell us some of the issues that LGBT people face specifically in aging and health care and care facilities? We're talking about this particular community, so there must be, we're addressing special needs. And I'm sure you have a good insight into what those are and the conflicts and problems.
Sure. I mean, as I said before, you know, a lot of the issues that all folks who are aging are dealing with, you know, will I have an adequate income to support myself? Where am I going to live? Who is going to help me out when I need help? If I live in a walk-up and my mobility is difficult, who's going to help me bring my groceries upstairs? Am I going to have adequate health insurance? You know, who am I going to spend my time with? You know, those are many of the issues that all older folks deal with. For lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender elders, there may be additional layers to that. So that, you know, a lot of times what we tend to think about is, you know, what are the networks and what are the resources that are available to folks? And we think about lots of systems, like, well, the medical community, that's a place to turn to. So if you're not feeling well, you know, go to your doctor or go to a hospital or pursue medical care. well, if you are a transgender person and if you have been, you know, undergoing hormone treatment, or maybe you are actually not even doing it through a licensed physician, maybe because of finances you're feeling like you've needed to access them on the black market, or some other way, then you don't have a sense that the medical community is going to be responsive to you. Or as a trans person, how will I be treated? You know, that I've heard a story of a trans person who I believe ended up in an emergency room and, you know, found themselves on a gurney with nurses standing around them gawking because their body did not, you know, their biology did not match their outward appearance. That's not going to, you know, that's not going to inspire somebody to head to the emergency room when they're not feeling well.
Well, the treatment is certainly huge. You've, in reading through some of your material, you've outlined some very simple ways that hospitals, care facilities can make themselves much more friendly, even as simple as changing the forms. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. I mean, again, if you think about the paperwork of life, as I like to refer to it, you know, when you're faced with those incredibly tedious pieces of paper that add, you know, and so much of the time, either as a consumer, we're faced with that paperwork, or as a provider, we're faced with completing that paperwork for folks. There's lots of little boxes to check off. And so thinking about whether you're asking basic demographic information about people, first of all, none of our paperwork ever asks about people's sexual orientation. You know, where in life do you ever fill out a form where you're ever asked about your sexual orientation? Can you think of any examples?
Never, and never any driver's license. We're supposed to just somehow fit, somehow, and you have to put a check mark somewhere, but somehow right. You're just supposed to fit.
My best, you know, in racking my brain and looking at lots of different kinds of paperwork and forms, my best guess was that, you know, traditionally, if a woman were to write down that her name is Mrs. Jane Smith, we would assume by the fact that there's a Mrs. that she currently is or has been married, and therefore by being married has an opposite sex husband. There must be a Mr. John Smith to go with Mrs. Jane Smith. Now, in Massachusetts, since we are the only state that allows for same-sex marriages, Mrs. Jane Smith could be married to Mrs. Jill Smith. So we confuse things a little bit here, but we really don't have, you know, other ways in which we indicate our sexual orientation. For gender identity, obviously, I think lots of us have seen boxes that say male or female. But, you know, what about a person who's transgender? How are they going to identify? They may be, you know, are they identifying using their biology? Are they using sort of the identity that they live with every day? Lots of the demographic forms that ask, are you married, widowed, singled, or divorced? So a person who's been in a 35-year committed relationship with a same-sex partner, which box do they check off? Are they married? Well, they may feel married, but they're not legally married. And that I've actually worked with forms in the past where that had, you know, when asked sort of who does the person live with, spouse, family, friend, other. So whose relationship wants to be recognized as an other?
Absolutely.
Again,
that makes...
this is the kind of stuff that just, you know, in no way does it convey that there's a box available, that there's space available for someone who doesn't fit into the boxes.
Well, this is absolutely and a very interesting topic you're bringing up about fitting into the boxes. I have a, as you, I think I mentioned to you, I'm physically located in Tallahassee, Florida. I have a story from Tallahassee. A couple, Joy and Sheila, were allowed residency in Tallahassee, Florida. It's a very nice, in fact, it's probably Tallahassee's finest care facility, the assisted living type of facility. They were allowed to live together in a room only if they pretended to be sisters.
Uh-huh.
And eventually they caused enough trouble. Now, isn't that the very definition, you know, as long as, you know, nice people, you know,
they just
keep her.
Yes.
Right. Words. And eventually they got the facility to clarify the position and to allow unmarried couples in stable relationships to treat them as couples who could live together. But that has a lot to do with checking boxes. We just don't always fit.
Right. And I think it also raises a really good point. And one of the things that, when I'm doing trainings and when we're talking about these issues, I think it's a really important point. You know, when we talk about older folks, everybody picks a different age at which the cutoff point begins for older folks. But if we think about people who are, say, 60, 65 and older, well, that older range gives us actually more than one generation. So if you think about, and frequently when I'm talking about LGBT elders, I will talk about folks who are a pre-Stonewall generation and a post-Stonewall generation. And when I'm talking about Stonewall, obviously for anyone in your audience who isn't familiar with Stonewall, was a bar, it is still a bar in Greenwich Village in New York City, and in 1969, during a fairly routine police raid, the folks at that bar, and the raid was based on the fact that there were gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people who were gathering there and socializing, those folks who were there fought back at this raid, and there was a riot, and many people think of that as sort of the watershed moment for the gay pride movement and for gay civil rights movement. And so when we sort of talk about a pre-Stonewall generation, if we're talking about somebody who was born in 1920 who's 87 years old today, that person would have been 49 years old when Stonewall took place. Now, if we think about somebody who was born in, 1950, they would have been 19 years old, and it would have been a very different stage of their life. And so I would think that the younger person I think of is sort of more of a post-Stonewall generation, because they came of age with the idea of a gay civil rights movement, versus older folks who really learned that the best thing that you could do in life was stay closeted, was to, not draw attention to yourself, and to pass as much as possible. And that's a very different generation. That's a generation, and again, I'm speaking in generalities, but that's a generation that very much might be living as sisters and might refer to each other as cousins, or might say, that these are two women who are roommates and have been roommates for 20-something years. But that's the language that they use in order to pass and in order to not raise suspicion. So it's interesting to hear a story where these women were asked to assume that kind of false identity and asked to refer to each other as sisters when they didn't want to do that.
I agree, and it's it's a terribly debilitating thing. Example, say your partner dies, and so you have to say to people, my roommate died, if you're using the example of a roommate. And people, instead of getting it, instead of understanding that your life partner is no longer with you, they say something like, oh, well, are you going to get another roommate? Or words to that effect. The level of being discounted is unimaginable.
Absolutely. And, again, I think for people who have lived their lives that way, where they have had to use that kind of artifice because it's their best survival strategy. I don't mean to diminish it in any way. It really was the best, smartest way to not lose your housing, to not lose your job, to not have the police come and hound you. That for those folks who have lived that way, you're right. They will get the response to the loss of a roommate. And people then will not understand outside of it. If people don't know about your relationship, they can't validate the meaning of that relationship to you. I mean, on the one hand, as I'm trained as a clinical social worker, so on the one hand, you know, if somebody said, I've had a roommate or I've had a best friend for 25 years and that person died, my general response to them would be, I'm so sorry to hear that you lost somebody so important to you. And that, to me, is, you know, that's a natural response because they've had a significant loss. And whether that is, you know, a spouse, a partner, a best friend, your childhood buddy, it's kind of an open and affirming response. And so sometimes when I'm training people, I'll say, if you can respond in that way, then sometimes it doesn't matter whether the person self-identifies or not. Because my, you know, part of what I'm doing when I'm working with folks is I'm not asking them. Lots of times, so, you know, professionals will say to me, well, I don't want to have to ask people, and I don't want to have to, you know, make them tell me something they don't want to tell me. And I completely support that. If folks do not want to self-identify, I don't want to force them to self-identify. There are lots of people say, oh, coming out is better for your mental health. Well, it is in the right context for your life. But if folks do not want to come out, I don't want to force them. However, I think it's important that we, on the provider end, create an environment that gives gay folks the clues that they will have a positive reception. And we're good at looking for clues. You know,
I should imagine
it amazes me that I will say to organizations, if you do something as simple as saying, you know, we provide support for caregivers. So if you're caring for a parent or a spouse, if you're caring for somebody on a regular basis, you're a caregiver. And I will suggest if you expand that definition to say that you are caring for a parent, a family member, a spouse, a partner, or a friend, just including the word partner will be a huge red flag to many lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people.
You're right. A simple word, a turn of a phrase, it would mean so much.
Just include the word partner, and you can get some real mileage out of that. Doesn't mean putting, you know, printing all your materials on rainbow sheets and, you know, doing something that's that overt. But we're good at looking for the clues that indicate. Now, you need to be able to give your follow-up to it. If you're using the term partner, be ready and prepared for an individual who has a partner.
Again, we are, this is a call-in show. The toll-free number is 877, the number 4 head-on. That's 877, the number 4 head-on. If you'd like to speak to myself and Lisa Krinsky of the LGBT Aging Project, or you can use 304-658-3333. Lisa, a moment or two ago, you mentioned housing and the threat of losing housing. Tell us about House Bill 1155 and how that affects Massachusetts and what's going on there.
Well, actually, that it does affect housing. That bill is something called the Mass Health Equality Bill, and it is actually the first bill that has been proposed to our state legislature that sort of follows through on what we refer to as the Goodrich decision, which was our state Supreme Court's recognition of same-sex marriage. And basically what we've done with this bill, MassHealth in Massachusetts, MassHealth is our Medicaid program, our state Medicaid program. And what we know that is unique about Medicaid programs, and this is true across the country, is that Medicaid is both a state and a federally funded program. So it creates, for those of us in Massachusetts, a unique distinction, or actually intersection, between our state law, which allows for and recognizes same-sex married couples as being a legitimate marital entity, and puts us sort of at odds with the federal law and the DOMA, which is the Defense of Marriage Act, which only recognizes opposite-sex couples as a marital, a legitimate marital entity. And Medicaid, as a resource for many folks, provides spousal benefits for couples, particularly when they're looking at long-term care, particularly if they're looking at nursing home care. And so I'm giving sort of a lot of background information on Medicaid for folks who may not deal with it on a frequent basis. So what our issue really was that Medicaid provides what we refer to as spousal benefits. So if a couple, let's say that we have a couple, Jane and Jim, and Jim needs to go into a nursing home to receive adequate care there. So the way Medicaid is set up right now, Jane and Jim own their home, and because Jim is married to Jane, and Jane is going to remain living in the community, when Medicaid looks at how much money do they have and what are their assets, because Medicaid is based on people's income and their asset level, it's a need-based program, they'll say, well, yes, Jim owns half of this house, but because Jane still lives in it, we're not going to count it as an asset. And for most people, their home is their greatest financial asset. So Jim gets access to the nursing home, and the house gets transferred into Jane's name and becomes her asset. And what that does is it makes sure that, A, she has a place to live, and that the other thing that happens is that Medicaid will take a look at Jim's income and Jane's income. And in sort of the traditional opposite-sex married couples, frequently we see that women were working in the home raising families and may not be making the same kind of Social Security income that her married husband has. And so there's an opportunity for some of his income money to go to her, because we don't want her to be impoverished or homeless. So Medicaid provides for the community spouse to get adequate income and have a place to live. That's a great, terrific federal policy for all its citizens, right?
Do you agree? Yes, yes, absolutely. It's a survival policy for so many people.
Exactly.
Unlike the media, we're not all rich. In fact, most of us aren't.
Exactly. Absolutely true. So here in Massachusetts, here's this interesting dilemma, because a same-sex married couple in Massachusetts wants to then get these same benefits. So let's say instead of Jane and Jim, we have Jane and Jill. And Jill needs to go into a nursing home. And the story is identical, except we're switching out Jim for Jane. And so, or Jill, or whoever I say.
I have the same. All of our listeners know that we're weird like that here. We're all aging. In fact, I'll tell you a little story. I just interrupted you just very briefly. I was telling my listeners the other day, in fact, for a month or two now that I'm 53, sometimes age comes up, I just realized I'm actually 54. We forget things, don't we?
You know what? So glad you told that story, because for the past year, I've been thinking that at my next birthday, which is next month, that I'm going to be 43, and actually it turns out I'm going to be 44.
There's a lot of this going around.
It must be something about turning from the three number to the four number.
It must be.
That gets a little confusing. So anyway, sort of to get back to the explanation for the Medicaid benefits for same-sex couples, what we've said is that we believe that same-sex married couples in Massachusetts are entitled to those same benefits, that the spouse who's going to remain in the community should be able to maintain their home, to keep their home in their own name, and should have adequate income. The way it stands now under the federal legislation is that that same-sex married couple in Massachusetts, the community spouse is considered to basically be a legal stranger. And that's the legal status that most of our partners have in, you know, most states in the country. Obviously, there have been domestic partner and civil union opportunities in other states around the country. But what that means is that if you have lived your life with a same-sex partner and bought a home with them and built your home together, that you are considered a legal stranger to the federal government. And they will look at that house and they will say, you own half this house with this other person, so the half of the house that you own, you, the person going into the nursing home, we're going to consider that to be an asset that we are going to look to reclaim towards payment for your nursing home care. And we don't feel that that is fair, quite honestly, particularly for people who are married here in Massachusetts.
So the effect of this would be that the person, that the partner would, or Jim, or rather Pam, or I forgot the names again myself, that the person would lose the home so that the other could go into a care facility. Is that correct?
Right. And what happens is it's not that they would actually show up on the doorstep and say, you need to move out now, but that that asset would be attributed to the person in the care facility. And so they might, at some point, Medicaid, when that person dies, Medicaid would want to reclaim the money that it had spent on that person, because half of the home is an asset and then part of that person's estate. And they will look to reclaim money from the estate of that person.
And obviously the only way to get that money is to sell it out from under the partner.
Exactly. And so, because really when you think about it, you know, you're 75 years old, you're living on a fixed income, your most valuable asset is the home that you live in, and for many of us, you know, you buy a home, you live there for a long period of time, the value of that home increases tremendously. And where at the age of 75 on a fixed income are you going to get hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy out your partner's interest in your home so that you can remain living in your own home?
I see. And this is in addition to the federal policy of not extending Social Security benefits to the survivor.
Exactly. There's an incredibly compelling film that, if your listeners have not already seen it, I tremendously urge them to go out and to rent or get access to. And it is from the second volume of the If These Walls Can Talk HBO series that was put out in, I believe the second volume was done in 2000. And if you're familiar with it, there's three vignettes, and the premise is that it takes place in the same house with three different generations inhabiting the house and sort of what the stories are.
Ah, yes, I recall that. Marvelous. That was really, really good.
It was, and in this volume, it's actually three stories of lesbian lives. And the first vignette stars Vanessa Redgrave and is a story of a lesbian couple in 1960 and who have been long-term partners, and one of them dies, and what happens after that. And I certainly haven't given the plot part away that one of them dies. But it's to see the experience that the surviving partner, played brilliantly by Vanessa Redgrave, goes through is just heartbreaking. And sometimes people will say, well, this took place in 1960, and of course the world is tremendously different now. And it certainly is tremendously different, but I think that a lot of the issues that the film reveals are still incredibly current today. So that's my plug for everybody to see this film, because it really illustrates so many of the points that we're talking about in terms of how family responds to them, in terms of what rights the partner has, the surviving partner, you know, that it's tremendously poignant.
Well, this is not about that particular movie itself. It's been quite a while since I've seen it, so I don't recall if anyone commits suicide in it or not. But there's so much talk. In fact, we've talked about it on this program before about young LGBT kids, teenagers who kill themselves because of these the things they have to get through. There is a hidden group of elderly LGBT people. Apparently, suicide is not that uncommon there either because of these problems.
Well, right. I mean, there clearly has been a tremendous focus on LGBT youth suicide and the impact that has had. And one of the things that we know sort of in general is that the highest, the group that is at highest risk for suicide is actually older white men, have a very high rate of attempted suicide. And that LGBT folks, again, we don't have great research and great data at this point that indicates it, but there certainly is, and as we've talked about all of these other factors for folks, there certainly is an elevated risk for LGBT folks, older folks, around suicide issues, particularly as we talk about the loss of autonomy, depending on other people, the vulnerability about who's going to help care for me, who am I going to spend my time with, that it is a tremendous concern in the community. And we here are actually looking to develop some training and educational curriculum around LGBT elder suicide so that we can help elder providers to better recognize and support folks at that point in their lives.
And depression is certainly a factor in that. Example of an LGBT individual in a care facility that does not want their partner or their friends to visit for fear the appearance of their partner or their friends would out them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a story locally of a gentleman who had been part of a sort of social network, a tremendous network of relatively open, older gay men. And he was, I believe, in his late 80s or 90s and had to go to a nursing home. And when he went, his friends, he was having a conversation with a friend of his about books to read. And his friend said, and he said, "Oh, you know, I've never read any gay literature and gay novel." And so his friend said, "Oh, I'll bring you some." And he said, "Oh, no, don't do that. Or if you bring it, you know, in a brown paper wrapper, if you can imagine." And close to his birthday, a group of his friends came to the nursing home to visit him, and he wouldn't come downstairs to visit them. He was afraid that they, as a group of men, would be identified as gay men, and that he would, you know, it's what we're familiar with, as guilt by association. And he was not willing to risk that for himself because of his dependence on the people who were providing care for him, as well as, I think, his concern about how he might be treated or isolated by the other older people there as well.
The other older people, and I understand you use the word isolated. I've read that oftentimes LGBT people are moved from their wing, they're with people at the same functioning level, because residents find out they're LGBT and move to wings that are to wards or dementia area, just to isolate them. Is this as common as I'm reading?
Well, I think that one of the things that I think is important for us to keep in mind is that we're all products of our generation, and that when, you know, we talk a lot about sort of the internalized messages that older LGBT folks have learned, that, that being gay is, it's morally wrong, it's a sickness, it means you're a deviant, you know, the whole sort of realm of negativity that we're well aware of around being gay or homosexual, which is the term that really was used for folks as they were coming of age. And the thing that we need to keep in mind is that for all of their heterosexual peers, that was the same message that they were getting as well about people who were gay. And so, you know, we know that things change over time, but if you think about it, there are plenty of heterosexual folks out there of that generation who also heard all of those negative messages and may not have had opportunities in their lives to meet other people, know other people, or have any opportunity to learn or know otherwise than that. And I know I sort of walk a fine line because it's not that I'm saying that, you know, folks are old and so they're entitled to their prejudice or their discriminatory beliefs.
I completely get what you're saying, though. I understand completely. We're raised like we're raised.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, one of the issues that I'm, when I'm doing trainings and I'm working with folks is sort of how do we work with the providers and what's the context for talking to providers about the fact that, you know, you have a job to treat everybody and treat everybody with, you know, good quality care. You don't have to like them personally. You don't have to agree with them on all matters of their life. But you have a job. You come here and you have a job to do, and this is what we expect from you. And that's always, you know, that's a pretty fair and reasonable expectation for professionals in the field. The issue for the people who are actually attending the senior center, the drop-in center, or are living in a nursing home or an assisted living facility, or attending, you know, senior citizen education classes, is a little bit different. And so the opportunity to reach those folks and to try and convey to them a message that we are thrilled that you're here at the Senior Center. We are a place that is open to all sorts of different people, and we want everybody to feel welcome here. We want everyone to feel like, you know, they are valued and they are respected, and that everyone's entitled to their own beliefs, but what we want to make sure of is that we sort of have some ground rules, some house rules about how we treat one another with dignity and respect. And again, that's another message that I try to convey. And, you know, it's interesting because I sometimes try and make the distinction between when are folks encountering homophobia, which we sort of know to be a clear kind of phobia, fear, or dislike, or hatred of folks who are gay. And I should say there's homophobia, there's transphobia, there's biphobia, so it covers all of the groups. And when are we encountering what I call homo ignorance?
I hadn't heard it. Marvelous. Thank you for the new term.
Which really is, I've never met anybody before. I've never seen two men kiss. I've never met a trans person before. I don't know whether, you know, when someone will say to me, so if that person's legal name is John Smith, but he says he wants me to call him James Smith, is he a he or what do I do? That's just homo ignorance. Well, that's actually trans ignorance. That doesn't mean they're phobic about it. It just means they haven't learned yet. And so I like to look for the opportunities where we can educate people, because there are also lots of older folks who are willing to learn something new. Or perhaps by having some of these conversations, we then prompt them. I'm doing a presentation, a panel at a local senior center in a couple of weeks, and I am bringing three people from my speakers bureau, an older lesbian couple and an older gay gentleman, I'm bringing them to the senior center, and we're going to do a little gay and gray panel for folks, and they're going to talk a little bit about who they are and their lives and their children and their grandchildren and their volunteer lives. And I'm assuming that most of the people who come who are in the audience are not LGBT. And they're going to just get some exposure to meet some delightful people who happen to be gay and lesbian and who are their peers in many ways, but happen to be gay and lesbian. And perhaps what it's going to prompt is they're sort of going, wow, she looks just like my neighbor. She doesn't look any, I've never met anybody who has self-identified as a lesbian before. She seems perfectly delightful. And that's a terrific opportunity.
Well, I should say so. And amongst the caregivers, there's so many examples where training could, or education, homo education could go so far. Examples of the lesbian woman, for instance, where nobody would bathe her because she was a lesbian. The countless examples you're bringing up, the issue of the trans person that the emergency room wouldn't handle,
ridiculed,
and so much of that. And you're doing a wonderful thing. I do want to ask you about funding, though. Apparently, in the 2007 budget, back when Mitt Romney was the king up there, he slashed.
That was governor.
slashed funding and vetoed just to a huge degree of anything that was LGBT or AIDS related. And there's a list as long as my arm of organizations, but one of them is the LGBT Aging Project that he cut funding to. How did you manage to survive that?
You're absolutely right. There was it sort of felt like somebody had done a word search in the 2007 state budget, and anything that did have LGBT in it got pulled out. So I felt actually good that we were in very good company, because the state schools program lost their money. There was domestic violence program for gay and lesbian and trans folks that also lost their funding. And
the gay men's domestic
other
violence
school education programs, yep, domestic violence. So there were a number of us felt we were in good company. What actually happened was he vetoed us in a line item veto, and the state legislature overrode his veto. And so we actually did receive the element of state funding that the state legislature had had approved for us. So we survived it, but we're proud to say that we overcame Mitt Romney.
Well, I think that's wonderful news. I didn't realize that. Now I'm looking at the 2008 fiscal budget for Massachusetts, and it looks like the Massachusetts approved $26.8 billion worth of spending, with only $860,000 of it, excluding HIV funding, mind you, was to services that were related to the gay community. You know, the domestic violence, the whole list. Are you affected by it this year? How is funding?
The funding is each organization, each wing of organizations is pursuing different services for aging, for domestic violence, for safe schools and youth programs. Has pursued its own individual avenue to receive those funds. I think you make a good point. We're clearly a very small percentage of the overall state budget. We have been very fortunate. 2007 was the first year that we received any funding for aging services for LGBT folks, and that funding helped us to expand our ability to work with the state-funded elder service network, so to work with those councils on aging and elder service agencies to make sure they had the cultural capacity to work with LGBT seniors. And we were very fortunate that in this current fiscal year, 2008, that we actually received a slight increase in the amount of funding that we received, which is great for us individually. I think But overall, we're still a small piece of a much, much larger pie.
And do you sell memberships, for instance, like a state association where they, you know, you get a newsletter and that sort of thing for a small yearly fee? Is that something you do?
You know, we haven't done that. We really have been an organization that has been fortunate to receive grant funding. And one of the many hats that I wear is being a grant writer and trying to get that. So we have pursued both some state funding, and some private foundation funding, so that general involvement. If people want to receive our newsletter, they just need to notify us that they want to receive our newsletter, and it's an electronic newsletter, and we send it out to them. We don't charge a membership fee.
Wonderful. I think I signed up for that. We are posting your link in the chat room, and it's available on the Strictly Confidential Radio site.
Excellent. And we very much want to be as accessible to folks as possible. Some of our trainings and some of the other things that we do have a fee associated with that covers a portion of the cost of educating and training folks.
Well, I'd like to jump to the White House Conference on Aging. I know a little about that. It basically happens every 10 years, and it has been the schedule. And it's huge. Every aging organization on the planet, at least in the United States, attends. The last conference was in 2005. Normally, the president addresses and listens, the vice president, et cetera. And the reason I'm bringing this up, Ms. Krinsky, is I noticed you were on the pre-White House Conference on Aging, and I'm not sure how that relates. Did you actually attend the White House Conference on Aging, and were you witness to this shunning of the I'm told it was quite a scandal.
Well, it was. I did not attend the White House Conference on Aging. The White House Conference on Aging is supposed to occur every 10 years. I believe that there was a more than 10-year span between the last Conference on Aging and the one in 2005. And this year, the way that it was constructed, and basically the White House Conference on Aging is the place that once every 10 years, it's the way that the federal government determines their strategy and their plan to address aging issues and services throughout the country. And I'm sure that the White House and the federal folks are well aware of the overall demographic change that we are expecting, and that given that the baby boomers have started turning 60, we are expecting that a huge, huge increase in the numbers of older folks that we'll be seeing in the decades to come. And so this planning process is that much more crucial at this juncture. The White House Conference on Aging this year was limited in number, and I'm not remembering off the top of my head how many folks were available, how many spots there were available, and folks were to be nominated to attend by through their local representatives and senators. So there was a selection process for folks to attend the White House Conference on Aging. And one of the things that we did here in the Boston area is that we knew that there were, because there's only a smaller subset of folks who actually get to attend the White House Conference on Aging, what they did in preparation for it is that they had a number of listening sessions across the country, so that there were community-based sessions that could then submit their testimony, even though they couldn't actually be there and participate in the conference to set the agenda.
Yes.
So we hosted in June of 2005, I believe, during Gay Pride Week in Boston, a White House Conference on Aging listening session for the LGBT community. It was actually a terrific kind of a town meeting to talk about LGBT aging issues, And we were pleased to have Barney Frank come and be our sort of our keynote speaker. Basically got to talk about LGBT aging issues, and we then did submit our testimony to the White House Conference on Aging. The conference was taking place in December of 2005. Because there was such a closed number of people who were attending and that the agenda was so limited, we actually got to participate in a right in the days prior to the convening of the White House Conference on Aging, a separate conference called Make Room for All, which was...
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you're bringing that in. That was my next...
Absolutely, which was actually a terrific opportunity for many of the groups who felt excluded and felt that their voice was actually not invited to be present at the White House Conference on Aging. So we had the opportunity to talk about LGBT aging issues there and had a number of people from across the country who testified. I was actually one of the expert listeners when folks were testifying, so that, got to hear their stories and ask them some questions about their experiences. And it was a terrific opportunity for an alternative voice to be heard. And we distributed buttons that said Make Room for All, and people at the White House Conference who were attending the official event were well aware that there were voices that weren't invited to participate.
Well, I understand that one of the methods that they used to accomplish to be sure that certain groups weren't heard from was constant schedule change. Did I get that right?
That may have been. I know that what happened was that there were actually the agenda was presented to folks, and then my understanding was, because again I wasn't invited to be a delegate, my understanding was that the delegates were really asked to focus on the implementation of the plans, not the creation of them themselves. And there was a tremendous amount of frustration, both around LGBT issues and broader issues as well, from that conference.
Yes, I bring that up in the broadest sense. I understand that the insult wasn't just for the LGBT community. It was the
absolutely,
and it was surprisingly
not. It was an equal opportunity.
Yeah, and how could you be so klutzy as to mess up your relationship with that community? I'm shocked.
Yeah. I agree with you. Yes, I mean it's interesting you say that. One of the things that we know, both on a local and a national level, is that older people are a really important political demographic. Older people vote. Older people have time to vote, and they care about many of the issues that come to the forefront. And so political candidates and currently sitting legislators really respond to older folks who express themselves. One of the things that we had heard here in Massachusetts, we worked closely with a lot of the pro-marriage advocacy groups, particularly Mass Equality here in Massachusetts, to ensure same-sex marriage. And one of the things that we heard repeatedly from legislators was that our ability to mobilize older same-sex couples had a huge impact on helping them to understand why same-sex marriage was so important. So as much as we sort of say that older folks are invisible and that they don't get the recognition and respect that is due to them, older folks have incredible political clout. And I would just use this to just say to folks that, pick up the telephone, write a letter, do sort of whatever is possible to do.
Okay, I'm not quite. Hi, are you still with me?
Yeah, sorry, it got a little fuzzy.
Okay, good. Yeah, it got a little fuzzy for me. I missed the last thing you said.
Oh, just that it's really important, and that older folks should pick up the telephone and don't be afraid to call your senator, your representative, on the local level, on the state level, on the federal level. It really has a huge impact.
Yes,
hearing
I
from older people really goes the distance with legislators.
Well, it's an invisible community, and it's. I'm so glad. I'm just so glad that this issue is being picked up because we focus on don't ask, don't tell. We focus on gay marriage, and we focus on. But this is a. So I'm so glad to hear there's a grassroots organization that's focusing on this. And speaking of don't ask, don't tell, and marriage. The Christian right, let's use a specific example, the American Family Association, is constantly running attack ads on gay marriage or don't ask, don't tell. In fact, it's a huge fundraiser is what it boils down to. Are you guys mm-hmm. flying under the radar, or are you getting hit by these people too?
I will tell you that we have actually... so far, and don't jinx me, Peter, have flown under the radar screen. Somebody was just asking me this the other day. I mean, given, we were really quite pleased with the front page placement of the New York Times article about aging LGBT folks. And we've had terrific responses from, all over the world. And the reader comments that folks responded to, the online reader comments, and not a single one of them so far has had any negativity. I have not had any kinds of, I just feel like the minute the words come out of my mouth, my email box will fill up with them. And my voicemail will be full of it too. But really, nobody has come forward to sling the kind of mud that I have seen flung, in every other direction. So I appreciate it thus far.
I can just imagine, pathetic old homosexuals. I always use the word homosexual. Pathetic old homosexuals preying on the children of the visitors to the normal people, or words to that
right.
effect. Catch
something. I'll tell you really, really, really quickly. I'll tell you a funny story. Early on in my, I had been just working with the Aging Project for a few months, and I had to do one of my first go to a senior center and do a presentation piece. And the folks who were hosting this event said to me, a couple of people have sort of said, why are you doing this? Why do we have to talk about this? This isn't something that we should be talking about here. And so I was prepared for some negativity, and I drove up to the senior center that day, and the parking lot was filled. And I thought, oh, here it goes. I'm going to have to face, 100 angry, homophobic folks. Okay,
sure.
And I just sort of, pulled myself together and walked through the door and went into the auditorium room where there was a handful of 25 people waiting for me. And I said, well, gosh, the parking lot sure was full. And they said, oh, yes, there was a bus trip to the casino in Connecticut. And that's why the parking lot was full. It wasn't that they were out, waiting for me. It's that everyone had come to the senior center to go on a bus trip. So I was afraid that I was going to have to face it, but luckily didn't have to.
I'm glad you didn't. They're probably raising all the money that they can with the gay marriage issue. Maybe you'll be spared. I certainly hope so. It seems like an indefensible position that they would start beating up on the elderly. Maybe they're afraid of it.
Possibly it could be. I mean, there are people who still will say, well, we don't want that kind of thing happening here, and... Right. I don't actually know why we haven't received more negative attention, but we've been fortunate not to.
Well, I'm wondering about the issues lesbians versus gay men, or at least, I'm wondering, are the issues more traumatic for lesbians? Typically you talk about over the course of a lifetime that women earn less and all those things that impact, and women are especially women of color are kicked out of the military under don't ask, don't tell far more often than any other group, disproportionately to their, and of course that puts the, a dishonorable discharge puts a stigma on their work record and all of these things. Tell us about women and the aging issue. I think that they may have different issues.
I think you raise a good point. There are very clearly, the life experience for lesbians can be very different. I think you raised the issue about economics and income. And you're right, women do earn less money, fewer pennies out of the dollar than men do. So if you think about partnering two females and their incomes versus two males and their income, you very well can see some discrepancies. I think that being said, I don't want that to get used to reinforce the myth of the extremely affluent gay couple with tremendous disposable income, because I think that's a misrepresentation, and I think that there are lots of folks across the spectrum who have, a range of income, but clearly that has been an issue. We know that more women are working later in life, on into their 70s, out of financial necessity, in a way that men may not have to be working depending on their work histories themselves. So that definitely makes a difference for folks. And I think you raised the issue, too, about people in a variety of communities of color, and that has a huge impact for them because, they are also then carrying multiple identities. It's not that, you self-identify as a lesbian and then lose, the other communities that you may belong to.
And
for both
point.
Men and women, I think those issues about how they negotiate their identity, their sexual identity, along with how they negotiate their membership in their own cultural communities, may be an issue, and that I think applies for many of us. If you think about sort of religious communities that people belong to, and whether they have found welcoming congregations within their religious community or not.
I see. Tell us about Ethos.
Ethos is a mainstream elder care agency in the Boston area. And they provide us, we're basically physically based there. We rent space from them. And they represent a terrific model of a mainstream organization that has really, really made terrific efforts to be inclusive of LGBT elders. They're located in a community in a section of Boston that has a significant gay and lesbian population. And so they're located in a fairly gay-friendly community. And they've done terrific things. Like they have, within their general sort of friendly visitor program, they have developed a specific LGBT-friendly visitor program so that if there are older LGBT folks who would really like to have a friendly visitor, someone to come and visit them in their home or to go out with them, that they'll try and match them up with an LGBT person who would then be, just someone with whom they can be open about their identity and talk about their lives or maybe go to a movie together or do that kind of thing. And they also host a weekly luncheon site for older LGBT folks and their friends. So they have made terrific efforts to be a welcoming place for older LGBT folks.
Well, that's a huge step to the weekly congregate meal. to connect people back into the community who have very likely completely withdrawn, since officially older LGBT people don't exist. It would seem to me that that's a huge step to be able to do that.
It is, and it's been a really terrific opportunity, because what they found is that a lot of older LGBT folks were feeling reluctant to go to any of the other types of congregant meal sites at a senior center in a local community, or maybe located in an elderly housing building, and they just sort of felt like, I'm not going to be welcomed here. I'm not comfortable doing this. And so by creating, and again, they've done this along the model that they've developed meal sites based on, you know, ethnicity and cuisine. So that if there's a Latino population, they want to eat food on a regular basis that's familiar to them. That, you know, macaroni and cheese or meatloaf or whatever we're serving, mainstream American food is not what that population wants to eat on a regular basis. And it's an opportunity for socialization within their own language and all sorts of things like that. And so sort of to use a similar model for the LGBT meal site, it was to create socialization opportunities for isolated older lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks who wanted to connect with their peers and wanted to be in an environment where they would, meet other people like themselves. And it's, you know, open to LGBT folks as well as anyone who would like to come join them. And they have terrific entertainment.
Glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Glad you brought up entertainment. And in fact, that's where I was headed next. As we both know, assisted living facilities and care facilities all have the day room, and there's always something coming through. A gospel singing group I've seen, people bringing in dogs for petting, and a thousand things come through. Right. Imagining myself in a situation like that, you know, I wouldn't be the homosexual that stayed in bed. I'd be the one screaming, you know, Saturday Night Disco, being an old DJ. I'm not talking about hauling out, right, the huge speakers, disco ball. But what I am saying is we come from a different culture. Do facilities ever ask you about what would entertain them, us?
It's a great question. I think that more often I've sort of helped to suggest things to them. And again, to do it in a way that sort of normalizes this sense of inclusion. So, you're right. Lots of places have activities departments and directors, and their job really is to provide, you know, entertainment and socialization for folks. And for lots of the time, you know, they're recognizing, I'm sure everybody's gearing up for Halloween and Thanksgiving, and, Christmas is coming, and if it's a place that has, you know, a broader spectrum, they may recognize Hanukkah, and they may move into the Chinese New Year, and Kwanzaa, and, you know, they're really paying attention to the calendar, as well as paying attention to, you know, it's October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and so, you know, really paying attention to lots of time-related factors for people. And so frequently what I'll suggest is, you know, during June is Gay Pride Month. Why don't you build something in during June to recognize that as well? You know, maybe you want to start off doing something simple, like maybe you just, in your weekly film, maybe you show The Birdcage. Who doesn't love that movie? But, you know, it's something. It's a way to then say, this is on the calendar wheel. We're not we're not just, you know, doing nothing else at all, but we're integrating it and we're normalizing it. We're normalizing it into the schedule of events that we recognize. And that goes a long way. I mean, one of the things also, particularly for older folks, is that, you know, we may be able to raise these conversations and have staff and have elders, you know, talk about LGBT issues. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to suddenly come and find many LGBT folks amongst their, you know, at their senior center. But I will promise you that having some of these conversations will prompt people to start to talk about their own children, about their grandchildren, a niece, a nephew, a favorite uncle that they had. You know, that there really are LGBT folks in everybody's family. And so I really think that, you know, maybe by doing something during Gay Pride doesn't mean that a senior at the senior center is going to come out, but maybe someone's going to start to talk about their son, you know, in a very different way. Or maybe they're going to talk about their son and his friend. And then suddenly they're going to say a little bit more about the friend and that their son's friend has really lived with him for 15 years.
Yes, yes. Well, it's so important to have this conversation now because if people think they've never, and I've read this statement in doing some research for you, people think they've never seen an elderly LGBT person, you just wait 10 years. Now, this is telling me that there's estimates are that there's 2.4 million LGBT folks over the age of 55. And many of us, although we have done caregiving for our mothers and fathers and for our families, often we don't, in fact, the majority of the time, we don't have families of our own, with the exception of maybe having a partner. Many of us don't have children. So we're going to have to depend on these facilities. This is our option.
Well, you're right, but I would also sort of reframe that a little bit because I think that you're right, that the traditional, and again, when I'm talking to folks about this, I try and connect it back to broader changes that we're seeing just in the aging field in general. So I think that overall, we're seeing a change in the definition of family. The traditional mom, dad, the kid, the grandparents, you know, the white picket fence. Across the board, we see that changing. And so you're right. I think that for many LGBT folks, as they're changing, as they're aging, they're looking around and they're saying, you know, who is my natural default as a person to look? You know, if you have to fill out emergency contact, who do you put down? You know, and are you putting down, you know, the natural assumption would be a biological family member or a spouse. But there are plenty of people who are using, you know, families of choice. You know, who are the people you spend the holidays with? Because that can be very, very telling about who's important in somebody's life. And that also, I think that, sort of given the community's response to the AIDS crisis in the past 25 years, we have a really good working model for being caregivers to one another. And I think we shouldn't just assume we don't know how to do this and that we are going to have to rely on other people.
That's an excellent point. I'm so glad you brought that up. It had not occurred to me.
We've already done this. But in the past 25 years, now when you talk about the intergenerational issue, somebody who is 27 today, AIDS and the AIDS crisis is old history to them. You know, they didn't live through this process of how do we develop, you know, where did any type of AIDS action organization come from? You know, if we don't do this, no one's going to do it for us. And so we really have a foundation to work from. And I think that's a true, you know, we're talking about sort of all the negative aspects, and I wanted to include that in our conversation because we as a community have strength. And I think that this is a terrific asset.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing these things up. I, as a host, often go toward topics that are, shall we say, a little bit grim. And oftentimes it's my guests who bring me a ray of hope because we're all as it's all as bad as I think it is. There's really just no point. So, and I truly, especially from our guests who are, for instance, LGBT and the you know, involved in various religions, and now you, it's good to hear a ray of hope, and it simply had not occurred to me.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing is, and it's sort of tying all of our themes together, you know, we're talking about issues about, you know, housing. And there are, you know, there are folks who are developing LGBT housing for older folks.
I'm glad you brought this up.
There are people who are creating retirement communities. Here in Boston, there's an organization called Stonewall Communities that is building residential, you know, residential housing, and a building that's in the Boston area for LGBT folks and their friends so that they can live, you know, in a sense of community in a building that they all share. And that there are going to be a variety. So for people who gravitate and who want to move into that kind of a environment, there are people trying to create those opportunities. There's a building that opened in Los Angeles last year. There are people who are really
Is that the Triangle Square? The one in L.A., where you mentioned the Triangle Square, is that the one you're talking about?
I'm not recalling the name of it right now.
Well, the reason I'm bringing it up is because the Stonewall is a high-end, from what I'm reading, it's high-end. There's nothing wrong with that. It's high-end, and it's wonderful.
Yep.
But interestingly enough, Triangle Square, there are 103 apartments located in the heart of Hollywood is what I'm finding here.
Yeah.
And the rents range from $230 a month, which is astounding, to $800 a month for people. How are they doing that? Can they possibly do that in Hollywood? And can we recreate that type of low-cost housing?
It's a terrific question, and I think that, you know, that it requires the efforts of local community leaders and folks with a lot of expertise in housing to look at creating affordable housing for folks. And you're right, there is a range that obviously when people are going to be investing their own money in their housing to buy into something, they can have, and folks will feel like sometimes they have more choices about where they live and who they live with as their neighbors. But creating a range of housing opportunities for folks, be it community-based, or a range of income levels, I think is also really important.
Yeah. Of course, in Florida.
Yep.
In Florida, I was about to say that aging is considered a growth industry. Odd way to put it.
And it is nationally.
Interesting.
Nationally. If you look at the demographics, I mean, the baby boomers as a, you know, an entity, if you sort of look at a demographic chart, you know that image of sort of the snake that swallowed the mouse?
Right, yeah.
With a big lump in the middle of it because the snake has swallowed the mouse whole. That mouse is the baby boomer. And so just as the baby boomers have sort of been on the cutting edge of all sorts of culture change because there's such a large volume of people and have redefined, you know, what does it mean to be in your 30s or 40s or 50s and now your 60s and upward, that there's a huge impact on redefining aging. And I think that LGBT folks will be contributing in their own way to redefining what does it mean to be older in the LGBT community. I mean, we've joked about it to sort of say, you know, I mean, you sort of envision that nursing homes have, or senior centers have, you know, they're playing oldies music. And
okay,
I just can't imagine that somebody's going to come into my nursing home and be playing, you know, Melissa Etheridge oldies songs for me. They'll be strumming along, you know, and other folks have been joking that, you know, we can't wait for wheelchair softball. I mean, there is a sense of wanting, you know, what you said before, you know, you're going to want disco music. I'm going to want disco music. I mean,
sure.
that that just as you, you know, you cater to who your clientele are. And I think that that will be, I think that that will happen with baby boomers in a lot of different ways.
I see. Well, that's an interesting answer. I want to ask you, too, about HIV. For instance, in Florida, there's an association called the Florida Association of Homes for the Aging, okay, and their membership tends to be not-for-profit nursing homes. Now, I know for a fact they offer videotapes and courses to train these non-profit facilities in HIV. So obviously, people, even though nobody thinks older people have sex, obviously they do, and obviously HIV is an issue. So it seems that people are trained about HIV. In other words, is there something about HIV in this that we need to know, a barrier and the way it relates to your training regarding homosexuals and HIV?
Well, I think you raise a really great point with this, and it's which is that, again, overall, HIV in people over 50 is a huge and a growing issue. Transmission rate. We have two cohorts in the HIV category. One is that we have, because of the progress we've made, we have people who are living with HIV and aging with HIV at a rate that we hadn't seen before.
Agreed.
So people are suddenly, I'm 20 years living with HIV, and I might have been 42 when I contracted it, but I'm now 62. So we have that cohort, and then we have this tremendous increase in HIV transmission and new cases of HIV being diagnosed in older folks, and that is because it's a couple of reasons. One is that people are sexually active, and that, you know, even though our culture says, you know, you hit that certain age, 60, 65, whatever it is, and suddenly we think you're no longer active, that's not true. That things like Viagra have really provided for, you know, a level of activity later in life than we had seen in previous decades. That we have older women, heterosexual women, who married when they were relatively young in their 20s, might be married for 40 years, might have lose a husband to death, and they are suddenly in their mid-60s. They are a low-risk group because they have they've had one previous partner, their husband, and he has died, and they may be dating again, and they miss the whole safer sex education message. It didn't apply to them. And so they're at risk. So we're definitely seeing issues around HIV and older folks that's growing and that's important. You know, the concern and sort of the line that I walk is that this is an issue that has huge impact on the LGBT community, but I also don't want folks to automatically link HIV and the LGBT community. For the HIV community, it's important because people need to know that that heterosexual folks are contracting HIV. It's not the gay disease. And for folks, you know, knowing things about the LGBT community, that's not the singular illness that LGBT folks are dealing with. So I always add those two caveats to it. But it is an absolutely critical issue. Medical providers really don't know how to... We don't know what it means to age with HIV. We don't know what the impact of the medications are on older people. What do we know about a distinction between, you know, an Alzheimer's-like dementia or an HIV or an AIDS-related dementia? You know, there's
good
a
point.
Lot of... There's an organization called HIV Over 50 that, you know, is really bringing increased attention to this issue. So yes, and when I talk to elder service providers and I mention HIV, they, you know, I don't know. I've worked in the field of elder care, you know, for nearly 20 years now, and my experiences were that we knew about consent forms and for guarding people's privacy about their HIV status, but we never asked directly if people were HIV positive or not. We don't include it on our radar screen.
This is a very good point, because in the beginning, the care was for people who are going to be dying soon. Nobody expected people to live 20, 30 years with HIV, so we're going to have to figure it out as we go. You're absolutely right about the medications. There is no research, for instance, when you get older, you have to take arthritis medications, you have to take heart medication, and who knows how these things interact with stack of... And there's no way to do that research unless you're doing it on AIDS patients or HIV-positive people. And there's no way to do that until they age.
As they go along, right. I mean, you know, as they're learning as they go along.
Very interesting point.
But, yeah, it has historically had a huge impact on this community. And, you know, I think I said earlier about sort of what's the historical impact that that AIDS has had on the community. And first off, I know this is going to come out sounding wrong, it provided us with this opportunity to create a network. It was not an opportunity that anybody went looking for. But in response to it, I think the LGBT community created a powerful response. But, you know, the other thing that the HIV and AIDS has done is it really reduced significantly the number of people in that generation. That if you think of the numbers of primarily gay men, but also of many, many women, who were lost to AIDS over the years. Exactly. That if you think about sort of what happens in a slice of demographics when there's a war and when a significant percentage of the population is lost, that that we need to think about that too, and need to think about, you know, for men who survive, you know, an era where so many of their friends and their partners and their community vanished around them. What will it be like for them 20, 30, 40 years later when they are at a stage in their life where that is happening again because of the nature of being an older person and having your friends die around you?
Very good point.
How does that impact on grief? How does that impact on, you know, people's experiences around bereavement issues? Or does that also mean that that's a population that has that many fewer people to turn to because they've lost them at an earlier stage in life?
Well, I want to ask you, and here we're probably getting close to, we're probably about five minutes or so before we need to close out the show, but if you could offer some suggestions about getting your affairs in order, do you have a checklist or some advice about preparing for this?
You know, it's an excellent question. I think that one of the things that's most important, and again, this is something that I think applies across the board, not just to older LGBT folks, I think it's really important to have a healthcare proxy. I think it's really important to identify somebody and to put it in writing around, you know, who do you want to speak for you when you are unable to speak for yourself? Because our legal system, has a default which goes to your next of kin. And if your next of kin you know, and your bloodlines are not the people that you want to make choices and decisions for you about your health care if you're incapacitated, about your possessions if you're unable to make those decisions, about your how you die, or about your whether you're buried or cremated, whatever those things are. We all have the right to that kind of self-determination. But make your desires known and identify somebody that you want to act on your behalf and put it in writing and make copies of it and have people know that. Because I think there's a tremendous amount of pain that people endure when that isn't done in advance.
That's exactly something I have not done, and it's advice I need to listen to, absolutely.
And you know what? We all have an absolute, you know, disinclination to do it because it makes you face issues of incapacity and mortality, and I would assume that more people have not done it than have. But it's, you know, if you think about it as an act of empowerment rather than an act of disability, maybe that makes it a little bit easier to do.
And in the last minute here, I want to ask you if there's I've asked you so many questions, out of some of them from left field, some of them you've marvelously handled every one of them with great ease and expertise. Is there something that I've missed here? Is there something that you'd like to just say that I'm not asking?
Well, I think first of all, your questions have had tremendous breadth, and you have definitely touched on lots and lots of things. But one thing that I'm not sure that I sort of underscored enough is issues about caregiving. It's sort of related to what we were saying about the community and what's developed, but that LGBT caregivers are also an important entity to think about. People who are providing care for family members or partners or friends, and that there can be unique issues for those folks as well. That there's a study that was done that shows that there are about 20% more LGBT folks providing care than heterosexual folks, 1 out of 5 versus 1 out of 4, and that there can be unique issues for caregivers as well, and we should support one another providing care for family and friends. Because caregivers are often seen as a sort of invisible amongst the invisible population.
Well, that's wonderful advice. And in closing, all of our conversations about setting up the program have pretty much been by phone. I would love to have your email address. If you wouldn't mind dropping me an email to peter@headonradionetwork.com, I would appreciate it. I'd love to stay in touch with you. And in addition to that, you're welcome back on this show anytime. You don't have to have a set interview. If there's something going on, pick up the phone, call the toll-free number. I'll put you on the air.
That would be absolutely terrific, Peter, and I thank you for your time and your interest, and for you and for any of your listeners. It's LGBTAgingProject.org, and would love to be in touch with anybody who cares about this issue. So I thank you for your interest.
And thank you. And the chat room is saying thank you. It was a wonderful interview. The chat room loves you. And good evening to you. And again, another wonderful guest on Strictly Confidential. I can't begin to tell you how blessed we are with these people. We are truly.